Hey, this is Dan Altman, and welcome to episode 6 of the Smarter Scout podcast, The Why in Analytics. Now, you may recall in the last couple of episodes, we were looking at mathematical models of the game of soccer, football, or association football, whatever you prefer to call it. And we found that we could put value on specific actions within the frameworks of those models to connect specific actions to our objective, which in this case was winning games. Now, of course, you can also break those models down to look at specific actions that you want to label out on a bespoke basis. For example, the average ball progression expected goals per cross for a fullback, or the average contribution to shot creation expected goals for balls played forward by a central defender. But the thing is, there's so much more that we might want to measure that's not necessarily included in the models. Remember, the models are about connecting actions to an objective, in this case, winning. But there are other things that matter to us, like player style, for example. You know, it's important to look at style because there are two players who may seem equally effective in the mathematical models, but they might achieve those contributions in vastly different ways. And those things matter to a club, right? Because a club usually has a playing style or a couple of styles that they use, and they want people who are going to fit in. So we need to be able to describe a player with data and bring him or her to life. You know, it reminds me of a scene in The Matrix, the film by the Wachowski brothers, or brother and sister now. And in that scene, Joe Pantoliano's character was looking into a screen and seeing just a jumble of all sorts of characters flying across the screen. But for him, it had meaning. He could point at the screen and say, there's a blonde, there's a brunette. He could see what the numbers and letters and other characters were describing, and they came to life in his mind. Well, we want to be able to do something like that with data. So when we see certain numbers pertaining to a player, we say, there's a target man, or there's a mobile striker, or there's a ball-playing central defender. Those are things that we want to be able to pick out. So can we identify types of players this way? Well, we certainly can try, but to do this, we're going to need a set of pretty distinctive actions at each position to separate the different profiles. We know that there may be different profiles just at the same position, so we need to look at the actions which are going to suggest something about those profiles, and they might not just be a simple action like a tackle. They might be something to do with positioning and timing as well, and when we choose those actions or whatever they are, situations, as numerators for our metrics to measure style, we need to make sure that we choose the right denominators too, as we discussed very early on in this podcast series. Now, for a Smarter Scout, we use 8 dimensions of style to describe players all over the pitch. Disrupting opposition moves, recovering moving balls, aerials, link-up passing, passing towards goal, dribbling, receiving in the box, and shooting. And we might want to measure these with different denominators, right? Because some of them are about defending and some of them are about attacking. We list all that information on the site so you can see how we evaluated those choices. But for simplicity, we're going to use the same dimensions at each position. And that means that for these dimensions, at least, we're looking at goalkeepers, for example, sort of like outfield players, to see how much they get involved in these different actions. But you can imagine that some of them have different meaning for different players. You know, if a striker does a lot of aerials, that means something a bit different from if a central defender does a lot of aerials. But, you know, we could imagine getting much more specific than this. We could imagine defining them on a much more specific basis for each position. But for simplicity, we do it this way. It would really complicate our visualizations and everything on the site if we had different dimensions for every single position. But even so, even with this sort of generalized model, we still see specific profiles. For example, at center forward, if you have a lot of receiving in the box, a lot of aerials, and a lot of shooting, that suggests a pretty prolific target man or woman. At central midfielder, if you're disrupting a lot of opposition moves but also receiving a lot of balls in the box, we might have a box-to-box player. So we can use these dimensions, or any ones you might choose, to measure differences between players, and that helps to separate out these types. Now, for our search by similar player on Smarter Scout, where we're actually matching players by their styles, we just use a simple Euclidean distance. That means that we measure the differences between the metrics for our model player on all these dimensions of styles and all the other players in the database at the same position, and then we just square those differences and take the square root as you would for any type of distance calculation in the Euclidean space, and we just look for the players who are closest, who measure the shortest distance across those dimensions. But you can also do some clustering, for example, within positions to identify a profile or even across positions to match a club's style. So, you know, if you wanted to say, for example, you know, what are the four major groups of central midfielders, you could use some sort of clustering algorithm that would try and sort those four groups so that the distances within each group were minimized. So you got them as clumped together as you possibly could. Now, we don't just use these eight dimensions to look at style because we also have a measure of ball retention on the site. Now, ball retention is something that's quite different. It's not necessarily connected to winning. It might be connected to keeping possession, and that's how we define it. We say, what is the likelihood that a player's team is going to maintain possession after he or she has touched the ball? And we control for the location on the pitch and the type of action being attempted because, you know, not all passes are the same. We have short passes which have a high success rate, and we have longer passes which have a lower success rate. So we're going to control for all of that and try and get a feeling for how risky the style of play of the player is. And that's a sort of overall thing that looks at their actions in all situations rather than breaking it down into specific things. Now, in the past, working with clubs, I've used a lot of different style metrics that really are designed to fit what the coaches are looking for. We might look at measures of width and mobility, for example. How much players stray from the center of the pitch, again, you know, standardized to their position. You know, even amongst wingers, there's a huge difference in how far wide they go. You know, when Leroy Sané is playing left wing, he's one of the widest players anywhere. He's hugging the touchline. He's practically dancing with chalk on his boots, as they say. But, you know, Gylfi Sigurdsson, for example, sometimes he lines up a left wing, but he tends to like to cut inside quite a lot. So quite different. There's really no limit to what you can do here looking at the style metrics. You just want to quantify it in a way that's meaningful and that suits your purposes. You know, if you're looking to conform to a certain style, you want to choose dimensions that are hallmarks of that style. Now, let's move on from the discussion of style and let's go on to skills. We're not talking about the same things that we were looking at in the mathematical models. You know, we're not defining skill as the ability to pass the ball to lead to a high quality shot. We're talking about skills that are specific and that are identifiable early on, perhaps in players' careers, where there's just one thing that you can define really well that they do to a certain degree of expertise. So this is especially important with young players because we want to gauge talent to understand what their raw materials are. You know, they might not have learned all the tactics of the game and all the systems and everything, but, you know, are they a good tackler? Are they good in aerial duels? Things like that we can measure even at young ages just because they're participating in those actions so often. So, you know, there are also special skills for different positions. On Smarter Scout, we look at aerials, we look at tackling and dribbling, which we define as ground duels in and out of possession, and we look at finishing, and for goalkeepers, we look at shot stopping. So we only look at shot stopping for one position. We can look at all the rest for every position, but you can imagine that finishing is probably not as important for a fullback as it is for a striker. You know, in the history, short as it is, of sort of modern soccer football analytics, the development of these kinds of metrics has been pretty slow, in my opinion, or at least it hasn't gotten sophisticated that quickly. For duels, like aerial duels and ground duels, we've seen a lot of raw counting statistics and we've seen win rates, but these sort of muddle different bits of information together, or they leave out important bits of information like the quality of the opponents in those duels. For me, the breakthrough in developing these metrics really came from Todd Kingston, an analyst who was then at OptiPro, and now he's working for the New England Revolution in MLS, in a blog post that he had for OptiPro back in April 2016. He realized that these dual situations were one-on-ones of the same kind that you would evaluate if you were looking at chess matches or tennis matches. You know, one player against another. And the way that chess masters and tennis players are ranked and rated is through a system called the Elo rating system, developed by a Hungarian-American mathematician named Arpad Elo, and it was for rating chess masters. And the idea was to say, let's look at these two players going into a duel. We're going to assign them each ratings to begin with, and then depending on what the outcome of the duel is, we're going to make the ratings go up or down. And as players' ratings developed, you know, they were always going to get a little bit of a boost for a win, but they if they went against a player who was rated much higher than they were, then a win against that player would be so much more surprising, and so there would be a much bigger change in their rating. But if they beat a player who was ranked much lower, then it wouldn't change their rating so much at all. So there was this feeling that you could adjust the ratings based on how surprising the results were, how much news they gave you, how much new information you got about the player's skill levels. And this is really fascinating because it meant that their ratings could evolve over time. Now, of course, you had to account somehow for the fact that, you know, there was older data involved in that and there was newer data. And so you had to adjust somehow for the importance of older matches versus the most recent matches. And there's an adjustment factor built into most Elo rating systems to deal with that. But, you know, when I came across this, I thought this is a fabulous idea, but the Elo rating system has some qualities that I don't particularly like. So I developed a formula that's based on the same notion, but it's actually different mathematically. And I did it for three reasons. Because, as I said, Elo ratings typically reward any win, but I wanted the reward to be zero in the limit when the outcome was practically a certainty. So if there was absolutely nothing surprising about the outcome, why change the ratings, right? There's no news. So I wanted it to be zero in the limit. The second one, Elo ratings, because in part they reward every victory, they're path dependent. If you beat player A and then beat player B, your rating won't be the same as if you beat player B and then player A, if those two players have different ratings. So, you know, that means that the order in which you face the opponents actually affects the outcome of the rating. But you would think that, you know, after those two duels, if the outcomes were the same, it shouldn't matter what the order is. So that was another thing I tried to capture in my formula, that we wouldn't have this path dependence. And the final thing is that Elo ratings don't give equal outcomes to groups of events with the same probabilities. So imagine you win a duel where you were given a 36% chance of winning. That should, in principle, give you the same change to your rating as if you won two duels in a row that each had a 60% chance of winning. Because 60% times 60%, which is the probability that you would win both, is 36%. So you have one event that's 36% and two that you put together, and their combined probability is also 36%. You would think that if two 36% events came up, then you would have the same change in the rating. So I also captured that in the formula that I use. So the Elo ratings were a fantastic idea. It was a great insight by Todd. If there were a Nobel Prize for soccer football analytics, then Todd should be one of the first recipients for sure. But I wanted to make some modifications. Now, once we've done this, we have the opportunity now to compile these ratings for players over the course of seasons and as long as we can track it back, right? Because every time a new player comes in, you know, enters a league, we want to have rated all the other players who were there already so that when this new player comes up against them, we already can handicap those duels. So we have this really long time series, and the great thing is that as soon as a new player comes in, we already can do some of this handicapping. Now, for aerial duels, I decided to split them up into duels in open play and duels from dead balls, because those are obviously very different situations. But a recruitment officer at a Premier League club, when we were discussing Smarter Scout, actually suggested that we further handicap these duels by the location on the pitch, since the players would be in different situations, even if it were an open play. Obviously, open play in your own box is different from open play in the opposition box. And this was a great idea. It didn't actually change the eventual ratings much, because they were standardized by position, and people who play the same position typically operate in the same area of the pitch. But what it did was it helped the ratings to converge more quickly to the sort of true values that represented the talent of those players, because it reduced the size of the variance in the changes in the ratings. So, you know, we wouldn't be off by as much because we were handicapping. We're doing a better job handicapping, and we converged to the sort of true ratings faster. So that was a really cool insight as well. Now, those are for aerials. What about ground duels? Well, ground duels are a little bit different, right? Because we don't just have two players going up for an aerial ball and you treat them both the same. In a ground duel, there's usually one player who's on the ball and the other player's off the ball. One is sort of the dribbler and one's the tackler. So, you know, how do we deal with that? Well, it turns out it's pretty simple. We just use two separate accounts, as it were. You have your dribbling account and you have your tackling account. And we're measuring each set of those duels simultaneously and chronologically so that we are rating you as a dribbler and as a tackler at the same time. And every time two players go into a duel, we are using those two sets of ratings to handicap it. And it doesn't matter that the two sets of ratings are based on different things. We're still putting those numbers into the formula. So actually, we could rate the ground duels in exactly the same way as we did the aerial duels with this one extra wrinkle. Now, after creating these ratings for duels, which you know I put straight into the metrics that I was using for players and was a great way to start evaluating them for these skills, it occurred to me in the summer of 2017 that we could do the same thing for shots. Treat each shot as a duel between the striker and the goalkeeper. It's an oversimplification maybe, but it turns out to be really useful. You know, the problem was that if I did it this way and I said, okay, we've got a striker who's shooting, we've got a goalkeeper who's trying to stop it, and I can just treat it just like the dribbles and tackles in a ground duel, you know, two sets of accounts, again, same thing, seemed like a great idea. But the problem quickly came up that if you track the ratings over time, you know, the goalkeeper would save a bunch of shots and his or her rating would go up, 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 and then concede, and then the rating would dip. So it would be up, 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 and down, up, 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 and down, and the opposite for strikers. And that meant that if you had to sort of know where in that series you were looking at the goalkeeper or the striker, because it would determine to a great degree what the rating would look like. So we had to figure out a way to smooth it out somehow. And the solution to that was to actually put the shots in batches. So we would have a batch of shots rated with certain expected goals, and then we would compare how the strikers perform with the goalkeepers. So that was the key insight to smoothing out these ratings, and it's explained a bit more on the Smarter Scout FAQ. But what it did was it smoothed out these ratings, and it allowed us to start seeing trends over time in both the finishing and the shot stopping. Now, one question that I often receive about these is whether we count shots that are not on target. And the answer is yes. There are a lot of people who focus on shots on target when they're just trying to evaluate goalkeepers especially. But there's been quite a bit of work in ice hockey and some in soccer football as well, suggesting that the goalkeeper has an influence on virtually all shots. And it makes sense, right? It's how the goalkeeper organizes the defense, cuts off the angle for oncoming strikers, and also does the striker note the goalkeeper's positioning in the goal mouth when deciding how to shoot. There are lots of subtle ways that the goalkeeper can affect it. And most importantly, we don't want to incorporate information about what happens after the shot is struck into a rating that's only based on prior information about the players entering the duel, right? Everything we're putting into this rating has already happened by the time the striker is about to take the shot. And so we're handicapping it on that basis. We're benchmarking it to expected goals and to the ratings of the striker and the goalkeeper. Now, what happens after that? It's totally new to us, right? So whether it's on target or not, what we're interested in is what the outcome is. So this work actually threw up some really interesting observations. As I said before, we started to see trends in the shot stopping and the finishing. Some players came into the rating system and they saw their ratings rise really, really steadily until they plateaued. An example of that would be Yaya Touré, one of the best finishers anywhere bar none. This guy, you know, he entered the league, his ratings started to go up, 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 and up from basically a prior of being an average player, and he plateaued at a point where it was no longer surprising that he was hitting these incredible shots and scoring. But others were quite different. They were not as consistent. You know, a guy like Wayne Rooney, for example, was usually above average, quite a bit above average as a striker, but he really had his ups and downs, and that's covering his Premier League career. There were streaks where he was really hot and where he was not so hot, and we'd see this for goalkeepers as well. But, you know, the rating that you get for them when you just look at it instantaneously would not capture that. You'd have to look back over the time series to see that they had their ups and downs. And it was important to do that. Some players' finishing actually seemed to be influenced a great deal by their roles. We saw Jordan Ayew, for example, when he played on the left and he was able to cut across the goal, he was a much more successful finisher than when he started more on the right and he found himself in a more awkward position where he wasn't used to striking the ball as much. And it may have affected his confidence, too, that he was playing in a position that maybe wasn't as suited to his game. So you got to be sensitive to all of these things. You know, there might be psychological issues, too, where a player is trying to get a move and he's not trying or he's sulking, all of these things. You know, we want to be able to incorporate all of these things into our thinking And the data are helping us to ask the right questions about what is causing those streaks to occur. Now, these ratings really became important parts of this toolkit that I would use to evaluate players, and especially the shooting and saving ratings, because they could make an enormous difference to the value of a striker or a goalkeeper. You know, a goalkeeper shot stopping could make a difference of, you know, 10, 15 goals a season from some of the best goalkeepers to the worst. And I'm not exaggerating that at all. So you can imagine how valuable a goalkeeper with a high shot stopping skill rating could be. But the biggest value really came in isolating these skills so that we could look at them no matter how well the player's club was doing. So, you know, a talented goalkeeper on a struggling club might not have many clean sheets, but we could still measure the shot stopping skill, especially if he was facing a lot of shots, right? I'm going to end the discussion of the skill ratings with what I consider to be the biggest challenge in this area, and that's passing. Because if you really want to evaluate passing in what I consider to be the right way, you have to somehow account for the ratings of the passer, the player defending the passer, the receiver, and the player defending the receiver. These are pretty familiar concepts to American football fans because the roles are much more specific. You've got the pass rusher and the quarterback, and then you've got the wide receiver and the cornerbacks or the safeties, right? Everybody has a job and you want to evaluate them based on that job. But in association football, as opposed to American football, it's not quite so simple because any player could be involved in any of those jobs. It's a huge challenge to evaluate these four players' roles with event data since we're essentially guessing who the defender is twice. You know, I discussed earlier how we try to estimate who the defender is on each attacking play, but in a pass, if you really want to evaluate the skills associated with passing, there are two defenders, at least the one defending the passer and the one defending the receiver. So the thing here is that we're losing some of the advantage in the skill ratings, which was the precision of being able to know exactly who was involved in these duels. If we use event data, we lose some of that, and there's more noise thrown in with the signal. Now, if we have tracking data, we might be able to help sort out this problem. Tracking data gives us a much better idea of who the pertinent defenders are on these plays. So I'm looking at that as perhaps the next frontier in skill ratings, where we can really do a good job at evaluating passing by incorporating all the skills of the people who are passing, receiving, and defending those two actions. I leave that challenge for the future of this field because I probably won't be the one to take it on. Anyway, that's a great discussion for us now of style ratings and skill ratings. For next week's episode, we're actually going to do a Q&A and we'll be soliciting your questions on Twitter, so you can send questions in, which I'll be able to answer at any length, not just Twitter length, on the next episode of the podcast. So once again, thank you for tuning in. I hope it's been useful, and take care.